this clock, it's 5 minutes till, so who knows. Sorry if I surprised you. Want to welcome you all here today. Welcome the participants in the Fifth Circuit Bar Association appellate advocacy training situation. Hope you enjoy yourselves. The first case, well, sorry, I'll just repeat on the time limits. We have traffic lights. We also have a timer. When the yellow light comes on, you have 2 minutes left. When the red light signals, we ask that you conclude your argument as quickly as possible, unless you're answering a judge's question. We have read the briefs and the record excerpts before argument. We have not necessarily gotten into the full record. One of these cases has quite a voluminous record. So with that, we'll call the first case of the morning, number 12-20379, Scott versus Livingston. Hear from Mr. Potapoff.
May it please the court, Alex Potapoff for the appellant. The district court's decision should be reversed for two principal reasons. First, the case is moot, and second, Scott's claims are meritless. I'd like to begin with the jurisdictional question of mootness. Scott's complaint was that there were irregular Jehovah's Witnesses meetings in the Huntsville unit in 2009. By the time of trial, that problem had actually been solved because the Huntsville chaplain had found additional Jehovah's Witnesses volunteers to provide regular meetings at Huntsville. In fact, Scott himself expected meetings to be regular at Huntsville going forward. But in any event, Scott was no longer at the Huntsville unit. He had been transferred to the Hightower unit, where there were, and this is uncontested, a rotating cast of 5 regular Jehovah's Witnesses volunteers providing 2 weekly meetings of 2 hours apiece.
What part does the settlement play in all of this?
Well, the settlement, Your Honor, is that's not a jurisdictional question, so you would address the mootness question first. And the settlement had nothing to do with his transfer or with any of the facts that I just mentioned. So the reason that he was transferred into the Hightower unit was that the independent Board of Pardons and Paroles concluded that he was a sex offender that needed to go through 9 months of the specific rehab program for sex offenders in order to be released on parole. And actually the settlement took place after he was released on parole. So the settlement is a sort of completely separate issue from the mootness. And so once he was transferred to the Hightower unit, his case became moot because he had neither the continuing harm, because there were regular services, nor any real and immediate threat of repeated injury in the future. In other words, he'd lost his personal stake in the litigation. There was no longer a justiciable controversy.
So why did the director decide to settle the case if it was moot?
Well, because the district court, of course, concluded that the case was not moot, but it did so on grounds that are clearly erroneous and which Scott does not defend here. And in particular, what the district court concluded was that while Scott may not have had a live claim anymore, that it could be inferred that he was bringing claims on behalf of other Jehovah's Witnesses. And first of all, there actually are no facts in the record about other Jehovah's Witnesses that were having irregular meetings at that time. But more importantly, in order to maintain a live claim for himself, Scott needed to demonstrate a risk of injury to himself. So for instance, in the Lyons case from the Supreme Court, the complaint was about an illegal chokehold, and Lyons contended that this was regular practice for LA police, that they routinely applied these chokeholds. But the court said that he had no standing to ask for injunctive relief because he had to demonstrate that he himself was sufficiently likely to be subject to another chokehold in the future. And it's exactly the same here. Whatever may be the case about Jehovah's Witnesses, Scott needed to demonstrate that he himself had some immediate prospect of once again suffering from irregular Jehovah's Witnesses meetings, and he couldn't do so. He hasn't really attempted to do so. So the primary argument that he makes with respect to this mootness issue is that the transfer from Huntsville to the Hightower unit should be regarded as a voluntary cessation of the challenged activity on the part of TDCJ.
Scott is a pro se, and he's the only plaintiff in this case?
That's correct. He's the only plaintiff. And so the reason that this should not be regarded as a voluntary cessation and treated under that rubric is that we've identified a number of cases from this court that treat transfers from one prison to another as mooting events.
Address the Judge Hoyt's difficulties with the settlement. He said it hadn't been consummated, as I recall, effectively.
Sure. So the only term of the settlement that Judge Hoyt identified as not having been consummated is that the that Scott was not given a copy of a revised administrative directive that was sort of changed to his satisfaction. And that's not a term in the written agreement. All that the written agreement says is that Scott gets $3,000, and in exchange, he releases all of his claims. And so, as Scott... I'm sorry?
What happened to the $3,000?
What happened was we went through the approval process. We created we obtained a warrant for the $3,000, and we brought it to Scott, and he refused to accept it in exchange for releasing his claims.
I thought he was put in his prison account, trust account.
Sure, it was a warrant for $3,000 to be transferred into his prison.
Well, but he did not accept it.
No, it was never transferred into his account, and so he now suggests that. It was significant to him to have a different form of payment, that he wanted it, in cash or in some other form of payment other than to his prison trust fund account. But if you follow the site that he gives for that, it actually turns out that all he says is that he could have used the money and his wife could have used the money. So this is really a sort of retroactive attempt to recharacterize the agreement. But the most important point in any event is that...
The settlement agreement did not address the question of how that $3,000 would be paid.
That's correct, Your Honor, but that doesn't undermine the agreement.
He was out of prison at that time, right?
That's true.
And since he hasn't accepted the money, if we were to uphold the settlement, you'd still owe him the money, right?
That's true.
So you could give him a check instead of, or make a check payable to him and his wife, for instance. Could you not?
We could in principle do that, Your Honor. I'm not certain what the procedures are. As the agreement said, the payment has to be approved by various officials, and I'm not certain whether
it doesn't say into his prison trust account, because he wasn't in prison, as you know, when he signed it. So it just says $3,000.
That's true. But the warrant, as it was ultimately approved, was to his prison trust account. And so all I'm saying is that I can't represent now that Texas officials would approve another check that was in a different form.
So the settlement's not final? Is that what you're telling us?
Well, no. The statement was final when we performed our obligation, and the court should have enforced it. But in any event, also as I've noted,
when did the settlement become final and binding?
Well, it became binding immediately upon being signed in February of 2013, and so then it became enforceable when we delivered the money to him.
It looked on its face like it was proposed a unilateral contract, if I can invoke an ancient first-year law term.
Sure. We believe that it actually evinces an intention on the part of both sides to be bound. So clearly Scott intended to be bound because he attested that he would release his claims in exchange for the $3,000. But TDCJ also signed the agreement. And the very next day, we submitted a motion asking the court to stay proceedings in light of the agreed settlement. So I think it's quite clear from the record as well as from the text that we intended to be bound. But assuming that it is a unilateral contract, then we accepted it by performance when we delivered the warrant to him. So either way, it's enforceable.
Do you happen to know the procedure if a prisoner is released, discharged, and has money in his trust account? Does he get that money?
I'm not certain precisely how the procedure works, Your Honor.
I assume he would. I mean, the obvious suggestion is that if he's already been released and the money goes into the trust account, then it's paid to him in some fashion.
Sure, I would assume so, Your Honor. I'm just not certain about the precise details. But he is currently still incarcerated because after being released on parole, he violated his parole and was then reincarcerated to a different unit.
So is he back in the same institution that has his $3,000?
I'm sorry?
So is he back in the same institution that has his $3,000?
Well, the $3,000 is not in any account yet because he simply didn't accept it. So we had a warrant for a transfer, but he didn't accept it. So that transaction was never consummated. But I believe the warrant has actually lapsed, so we would have to reissue it, but we're certainly prepared to do so if that's the ground on which this court rules. So with that, I would like to quickly address Scott's claims on the merits. Our LUPA claim in particular is foreclosed by this court's precedence at both steps of the RLUPA analysis. With respect to substantial burden, this court has held no fewer than three times in Adkins and Baranowski and O'Neill that the direct supervision requirement does not create a substantial burden on religious practice because any limitation on religious meetings is caused not by the policy itself, but rather by the limited number of volunteers. And so the way this court has summarized the doctrine in Sossaman is that there's no substantial burden if, quote, the small number of available lay volunteers makes religious services less frequent than an adherent would like, but still available on a somewhat regular basis. And that's precisely what's going on here. Under the Scott plan, Jehovah's Witnesses have at least one meeting every week, so that's certainly quite regular. It may not be quite as frequent as Scott would like, but nevertheless, that brings it squarely within the ambit of these three cases. So,
and you're still talking Huntsville, right? You're not talking throughout the, you're just assuming this applies to Huntsville.
Well, the Scott plan applies throughout TDCJ.
Okay.
So currently TDCJ policy is that...
Okay.
Yeah, in every unit...
You're responding to the way the case evolved, not the way it began.
Sure, but if we look at an earlier time frame, in the time frame of the trial, for instance, in the 8 months leading up to the trial, as we showed in the brief, Jehovah's Witnesses at the Huntsville unit had 26 meetings. So that's several meetings a month. That's also far more frequent than, for instance, in Adkins, where they had meetings once a month, and that was considered to be sufficiently regular to prevent there from being a substantial burden on religious practice. So Scott's RLUPA claim sort of fails at the outset at the substantial burden prong. And then the second prong is a strict scrutiny prong.
What relief did his pro se complaint seek?
I'm sorry?
What relief did he seek in his pro se complaint?
Well, it's not entirely clear. The way that the district court consistently construed it is as a request for an injunction with respect to the Huntsville unit only. And that actually creates a separate justiciability problem of redressability, because even assuming that he got the injunction for the Huntsville unit that he asked for, that wouldn't solve any problem that he could possibly have now because he's not in the Huntsville unit.
Is that the only relief he sought, was injunctive relief as to the Huntsville unit?
So that's how the court understood it. You know, it is a pro se complaint, so it's...
How does the state understand it?
We agree with the district court. The only concerns that Scott ever expressed were with respect to meetings at the Huntsville unit, but one could construe it more broadly to be TDCJ-wide.
Did he sue Livingston or Thaler? He did, right?
He did. So he did sue sort of statewide TDCJ officials. So with respect to the second prong of our LUPA, this court stated in Chance that its previous decisions confirm that the direct supervision requirement is a permissible attempt to accommodate diverse religious exercise with limited resources, and because the volunteer requirement is reasonable and necessary, it is the least restrictive means of furthering TDCJ's compelling interest in prison administration. And so under, for instance, this court's decision in Longoria, the fact that that Chance is out there and Chance has already concluded that the direct supervision requirement passes strict scrutiny, that actually precludes any further challenges under our LUPA to the same policy. And anything else would be a waste of judicial resources. In fact, with respect to the direct supervision requirement in particular, this court stated in Mayfield that the only reason that the district court had to evaluate the direct supervision requirement under the strict scrutiny prong is that there was no decision of this court at that time fully evaluating the policy. And of course, now there is such a decision, it's Chance, and therefore Scott's challenge was precluded at the second stop, step of our LUPA as well. And even assuming that the district court were writing on a blank slate, there was ample evidence in this case that the direct supervision requirement is crucial to prison security, in addition to sort of the common sense proposition that it's valuable to have somebody overseeing a large gathering of potentially dangerous offenders in prison. As Judge Posner said in Johnson Bay, the reasonableness of the direct supervision requirement cannot reasonably be questioned. There was also expert testimony. Robert Eason, who is a TDCJ regional director with ample security experience, explained at length why the direct supervision requirement is the best means of supervising prison religious services.
Your question, was this the reason, the only reason that the prison system sought to overturn Brown v. Beto?
So the reason that the prison system sought to overturn Brown v. Beto is both concerns about safety of Muslim services in particular, and also the consequences of this decision, which threatened to sort of...
See, Brown v. Beto has been in effect for almost 40 years. Is there any demonstration, just for the sake of argument, I gather that case is not tied to this one at this point in time. Is that fair to say?
That's true. It was argued about a month ago, and it's proceeding on a separate track. We asked for the two cases to be consolidated, but that motion was denied.
Okay.
But
what I'm saying is Brown v. Beto has been in effect for almost 40 years, allowing Muslim inmates to meet without direct supervision, right?
That's true, and in that case, we provided sort of ample evidence of, you know, fights in Muslim services and contraband and unmonitored Muslim services, and the sort of threat being manifest of an alternative hierarchy being erected in Muslim services. But even in this case, we pointed to Watson versus Wakefield and Lemons versus TDCJ, both of which discuss sort of severe disturbances that occurred in unmonitored Muslim services, as well as this court's decisions in Davis versus Wall and DeMoss versus Crane. For instance, in DeMoss versus Crane, this court discussed an unmonitored Muslim service where a tape was played that promoted violence and disparaged other faiths. I'd like to save the remainder of my time. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir. Okay, Ms. Milner.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Milner, and I'm representing William Scott. I'd first very briefly like to address the mootness question.
Are you court appointed for Mr. Scott?
No, Your Honor. Mr. Scott retained me after the trial of this case. And after the events surrounding the settlement.
Okay.
What do you want this court to do?
I would like this court to uphold the district court's final judgment.
I'm sorry, say it again.
I would like this court to affirm the district court's final judgment.
And what's the effect of that?
The effect of that is to essentially grant Jehovah's Witness inmates the same privileges that were accorded to Muslim inmates under the Brown versus Beto consent decree.
Any record basis for saying that?
I'm sorry?
They don't now have that?
I'm sorry?
Is there any record basis for saying that they don't now have that?
Yes, there is. The volunteer requirement, which the state refers to as the direct supervision requirement, is still in place. So Jehovah's Witnesses are still in the position that if they cannot obtain outside volunteers.
That speculates that might happen, but you have a sole plaintiff who brings a lawsuit that seeks injunctive relief, be charitable and say also declaratory relief, pro se complaint. The practice has ceased. There is no basis for capable of repetition yet escaping review because that must be specific as to him and not to others. Why isn't the case just on its moot on its face?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, first of all, the state asserts that Mr. Scott was moved to a different unit where there were ample volunteers and that there was essentially no chance that he would ever be moved to another unit where the situation might differ. But in fact, after he violated his parole, he was reincarcerated and he was moved to a different unit. That was after trial, so we don't have a full record of what the situation was there, but the record in the trial court shows that this problem originated because of the inherent variability in the provision of services by volunteers. The record shows, and I can give you some page sites if you'd like, that even when there are volunteers who are signed up who have the best of intentions, that they become ill, they have family problems.
Well, that's not the point. Why is the case not moot?
Because, Your Honor, it's very capable of repetition. Even if Mr. Scott is in a unit where today...
Excuse me, but he was removed from the prison. I mean, does a prisoner have a right to maintain the same lawsuit over and, let's say it's denial of access to the library, and he gets out on parole, and then he comes back 2 years later? Can he keep... assuming nothing has happened in the lawsuit, is the lawsuit still live?
Well, Your Honor, he was reincarcerated for the same offense.
No, he was reincarcerated for violation of parole, which is a separate matter. I don't understand this at all.
Your Honor, I don't think that his release on parole mooted this lawsuit. The case was fully tried prior to his release. And
all he wanted was to have access to, religious meetings X times a week. And once he's out on parole, he can spend 24 hours a day in religious meetings without the prison system having a thing to say about it. I just don't understand. This so violates fundamental principles to me.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe that that aspect of mootness was raised before the district court or litigated.
Well, as you know, it's jurisdictional. Do you have any case law to support that this is not moot, other than capable of repetition?
I was not prepared to address the issue of his release on parole as a matter of mootness, since it was not briefed or raised before the court, but I would be happy to submit a supplemental brief on that.
Is he back in the same unit he was in before?
No, Your Honor. He was sent to a different unit, the Powledge unit.
And that was not the subject of the early lawsuit.
It was not. He was moved twice in the...
Capable of repetition, yet escaping review. It's easy to slip past the stricture on that, which is very severe, that it must be, not that it's capable of repeating itself as to others, but it must be as to that particular plaintiff. The Lyons case and many others make that quite clear.
Yes, Your Honor, and I believe
Address that. How can it be as to him when he's in a different prison system entirely with that, which has not been the subject of litigation at all?
Because the rule is the same across all of the Texas prisons, the rule requiring a volunteer in order to have access to religious services. And the record shows that volunteer participation is highly variable. And so the fact that Mr. Scott is in a prison today, where today there's a volunteer, doesn't mean that tomorrow that volunteer isn't going to become sick or change their mind or have 10 other reasons why they can't show up, and Mr. Scott is right back in the same position where he was to start with. And requiring him to file a new lawsuit each time the same harm occurs based on the same rule, the same cause.
Well, he'd have to exhaust under the Prison Litigation Reform Act as to the new unit, it seems to me. And once he filed a grievance at the new unit, maybe they'd go out and find a couple more volunteers. I mean, this is the less preferable way of handling a complaint like this for somebody who's decided to go back into the prison.
Well, Your Honor, I can see the logic of that, where the complaint relates not to a general policy but to a specific event in which perhaps the prison is violating a policy, and it's easy to imagine that might be isolated at that particular unit. But in this case, Mr. Scott's complaint is about a system-wide policy that applies to each unit. There is testimony from the unit chaplain, in this case at the Huntsville unit, that he's not authorized to change the policy. So there's very little that a unit chaplain could do in terms of addressing the fundamental problem, which is that as long as the volunteer requirement is in place, the access that Jehovah's Witnesses like Mr. Scott and other members of religious minorities have to religious services is highly variable and extremely limited.
I suppose the other panel that heard the case on Brown v. Beto dissolves that consent decree and replaces it with the Scott decree. Then what's your claim?
Mr. Scott also has a RLUIPA claim that is not dependent on the existence of the Brown versus Beto decree. The district court initially decided against him. That was pre-Holt and pre-Hobby Lobby. After those cases were decided, the district court reconsidered its decision and granted Mr. Scott's RLUIPA claim, or granted him relief pursuant to RLUIPA.
So you're saying that Hobby Lobby does away with our authority in the Atkins and the Baranowski cases?
Yes, Your Honor. I do think that Holt and Hobby Lobby both changed the landscape of RLUIPA.
Except for the fact, actually, that, I mean, I don't... In what respect? I mean, the fact that there's a sincere religious belief was accepted in Hobby Lobby. I'm sure it's accepted here. So least restrictive means analysis in Hobby Lobby is completely different from what it is here.
Well, Your Honor, there are several ways in which Holt and Hobby Lobby changed the analysis that I believe was applied in Adkins in those related cases. One of those ways is that in Adkins and similar cases, this court and the district courts gave considerable attention to the fact that those inmates had other methods of exercising their religious beliefs. And in Holt, the Supreme Court specifically disclaimed that analysis, saying that the test was whether there was a substantial burden on this particular religious exercise, not whether, quote, not whether the RLUIPA claimant is able to engage in other forms of religious exercise. I think that is something that has to be considered. In addition, Holt in particular refocused the analysis on the statutory burden for the prison to show least restrictive means by saying that courts must hold prisons to their statutory burden. And finally, in Hobby Lobby, although the court did not expressly discuss the matter in this way, I think the court's holding shows that the idea that third-party action, such as whether a volunteer shows up or not, no longer cuts off the causation between a rule and the substantial burden. So in Hobby Lobby, the court did not find that the plaintiffs were not substantially burdened by the statute because Hobby Lobby, for example, maybe didn't even have any women who wanted to be insured, or Hobby Lobby's injury was caused by...
I'm assuming causation go to least restrictive means because they say they have a record of discipline problems arising from unsupervised religious meetings.
Of course, Your Honor. First of all, I'd like to say that there is, I think, a myth that's been created by the state in saying that what's requested by Mr. Scott is unsupervised religious activities. The final judgment entered by the district court specifically says that the state can provide any level of security that it desires. It just simply cannot condition access to religious services on the presence of a volunteer. The state now wants to tie volunteers to supervision of inmates. But the state's long-standing volunteer policy is in direct and explicit contradiction to this statement. The volunteer policy says, volunteers shall not, under any circumstances, supervise or manage offenders or other volunteers. Supervision of offenders and volunteers is a staff function. The state criticizes the district court for not giving credence to the testimony of Mr. Eason. Mr. Eason's testimony is very general. He says that volunteers in fact, provides supervision of inmates. That testimony is absolutely contradicted by the state's written policy.
What do volunteers do?
The purpose of a volunteer is to facilitate the service. That is to provide religious counsel and guidance. That has not been asserted by the state as some sort of compelling interest justifying the volunteer policy.
Are they ministers or?
They don't have to be ministers. They have to have some sort of letter of sponsorship from their religious body. But in general.
And they're trained, among other things, in security.
They receive some level of training. There's nothing.
Right. I'm not saying they're guards, but they are in there for a reason, and that is to make sure that the inmates don't start acting up. Aside from the religion, you know, if they were act up, then the volunteer would go out into the hallway and call a guard, right?
Your Honor, one can assume that that would happen, but
I think
the
you
state
can assume that would happen.
The state is specifically said that volunteers are there to facilitate the religious observance, and that they are not permitted to supervise inmates. And with respect to the state's evidence on problems that may have arisen in other types of services, there's no real direct evidence in the record. There aren't any incident reports or anything like that. Instead, the state cites to a number of other court decisions that relate in some way to some kind of problem at a religious service. A couple of these are addressed in the briefing. The state cites Lemons. This was a case, if the court goes back and reads the decision, there was some type of disturbance, but at the end of the day, no disciplinary action was taken against any inmate, and the service was allowed to proceed. In the Watson case, the inmate coordinator actually did exactly what Your Honor was suggesting. It appeared that there was going to be a problem. The inmate coordinator left and went and found a guard and reported the incident. Similarly, in the Davis versus Wall case cited by the state, the problem again was addressed before anything actually happened. And in the DeMoss case, the state argued and won that videotaping religious services that were led by inmates was an acceptable and effective form of security. The state has the burden here of showing not just that direct supervision, whether provided by a volunteer in contravention of the policy or provided by a guard, is somehow connected with security, but it's in fact the least restrictive means. And the state has not met that burden.
If you would save a little time to talk about the release.
Yes.
I'm looking at the affidavit. It's here signed by Mr. Scott, as well as I think it's an assistant attorney general, law enforcement defense division, as well on behalf of the state. And it recites a very straightforward release. I'm not sure I've heard any explanations to why that's not that this that doesn't bar this claim.
A couple of reasons, Your Honor. First, Mr. Scott was pro se at the time of this meeting. He was in there with two lawyers. He had no lawyer, and I believe the state is trying to craft.
How do you settle a case with a pro se plaintiff?
I'm sorry?
How do you settle with a pro se plaintiff? They weren't bypassing a lawyer. He elected to represent himself.
I do believe that the state is now trying to graft a legal meaning onto the affidavit that would not have been at all apparent to someone like Mr. Scott. First of all, it's called an affidavit. It's not called a settlement agreement, which would lead a layperson to believe that it was not a contract.
But the federal district courts in this court rely on inmate affidavits all the time in various kinds of controversies.
I agree that a court can rely on an inmate affidavit, but I think that's a separate question of whether it's a valid and binding contract.
He's literate, isn't he?
He is literate, yes, Your Honor.
He relied on his pleadings, didn't he?
He did write his pleadings.
His signature was sufficient, and it's about to get this whole proceeding started, and now he signs it under oath. We say we're going to disregard it because he didn't have a lawyer.
I do not believe he's trying to disregard his signature, but there are a couple of other things to take into consideration. One is that Texas rule...
I was commenting on your argument that because he was without counsel, that caused some difficulty.
I do not believe...
I'm suggesting to you that without, on his own signature, unsworn signature, he was able to activate the entire enterprise of access to the federal court. And we relied upon those, and that's why we're here.
I do not believe that someone who is a pro se plaintiff would have anticipated that something called an affidavit that was only witnessed by the attorneys for the other side rather than signed by them as parties would have been interpreted as a settlement agreement that was binding on both sides.
Anything in the record to suggest any why this shouldn't be enforceable other than...
Yes, Your Honor. Let me address another point related to that agreement. The state's counsel told you that... Mr. Scott was offered the $3,000 in the form of a warrant and that he simply refused to accept it. But what happened and what's supported in the testimony from the state's attorney and Mr. Scott is that several months after the meeting in which he signed the affidavit, the state's counsel again met with him while he was still pro se and presented him with a new settlement agreement as well as a multi-page release. Mr. Scott informed her that he did not intend to sign it, and so he was not given the $3,000. That release and that settlement agreement contained many additional terms that are not included in the release or in the affidavit. And in particular, the affidavit simply says a release of his claims, while the release the state sought to have him sign in order to obtain the $3,000 contained not only a release of his claims in this lawsuit, but a release of any future claims related to any matter in this lawsuit. So, for example, if he was in the future denied services, he would not be able to bring that claim. So,
are you arguing that there's another independent release that we don't have?
The release is at...
I don't know. Are you arguing that there was another release, a second release?
Yes, Your Honor. The state presented him with an additional release.
One. They replaced this one?
Yes, it's at page 1050 of the record, and that's what Mr. Scott refused to sign and why he was not given the $3,000.
Which one did he refuse to sign?
The second one with
Yes, I understand. The second one, but if he did refuse to sign the second one, what's wrong with the first one?
Even if the first one is accepted as a valid and binding contract, the state did not provide the $3,000. The state only provided...
I don't understand the argument about the second one. Which another agreement was never consummated, that it never reached, affects the validity of this one. I thought you were going to suggest to me that they entered into a new agreement and sort of a novation of this contract. So I still don't understand why this, as it's written, is not enforceable.
The state refused to provide the $3,000 mentioned in the signed affidavit because Mr. Scott would not sign a new and additional settlement agreement and release that contained new and additional terms that were not present in the affidavit.
What's your probative evidence of the reasons for non-signing or non-tender of the money? Because Mr. Potapoff said it was because he wanted cash instead of in his prison account.
The testimony of the state's attorney who was present at both the meetings is found around page 2455 of the record, and I don't have the exact page, but she testified that she brought him the $3,000 and the additional paperwork, and he would not sign the additional paperwork, and the paperwork was necessary in order for her to release the warrant. I see my time has concluded,
yes.
So unless the court has further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Potapoff.
So I guess you know what you need to respond to first.
I suppose that this last exchange about the...
It might be that.
What I would say, Your Honor, is in Scott's briefing, what he said was that the objection was to, lack of being given a revised administrative directive, and B, that the money was not provided in the appropriate form. And so we did ask Scott to sign a more detailed agreement at that point. And that's a common thing where you, in one agreement, you anticipate a more formal agreement later on.
Well, it's not just more detailed, but according to Ms. Milner's statement to us, it was broader because it dealt with any future claims. Is that right?
No, we think that it simply elaborated on the original agreement in that he was releasing all of his claims with prejudice.
Why do you need another agreement?
It was simply more formal, more detailed, and for instance, it provided.
More formal agreement.
I think.
The enforceability of this on its face, and you're also telling us, well, we also tried to get a little more formal agreement. I don't know what that means.
Your Honor, I don't think it was strictly
a weakness in the first one.
I don't think that was strictly speaking necessary, and
strictly speaking, I mean, what was it?
It was not necessary, Your Honor. I'd like to just read quickly from the original agreement because we heard from Scott's counsel that he would not have understood what it meant. But in the agreement, he said he attested that in exchange for the settlement amount, defendant will be entitled to a signed release and dismissal with prejudice of all of my claims and costs as plaintiff herein. So that's about as clear as it gets. Certainly Scott would have been expected to understand it. And so he should have accepted the $3,000 in exchange for it.
You were just reading from the first one, right?
From the first one. That's
right, so if the first one was just about as clear as it gets, then I don't understand the need for the second one. I
mean, we would be happy for him simply to accept the money and go with the first agreement. We don't need him to sign the second agreement. And I don't believe the record suggests that that was the sticking point.
All right. So you're representing to us, I just want to be sure I'm not putting words in your mouth, you're representing to us that it's the state's position that based on the first agreement, if he will go ahead and accept the funds that the state is willing to settle on that basis without requiring any additional release or any expanded or more detailed settlement agreement.
That is our position. It's also our position, of course, that the court should never reach that because the case is moot. And I wanted to quickly make a couple of points with respect to that as well. So, first of all, the new unit that he has been reincarcerated into, the Pallage unit, my colleague said that there was nothing in the record about it, but of course Scott is currently at that unit. If there were irregular Jehovah's Witnesses services there, he could very easily have conveyed that to the district court. He conveyed that to this court in the form of an affidavit. He's never done so. So I think that's a fair basis to infer that there are regular Jehovah's Witnesses services there, and in any event, it's his burden to show subject matter jurisdiction, and he hasn't done that. And also, with respect to the capable of repetition but evading review doctrine, the first prong of that test is whether or not the injury is too brief to be fully litigated before it stops, and obviously the direct supervision requirement gets litigated all the time. It's currently being litigated in Brown. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you, sir. Thank you, ma'am.